proposed NASA funding cuts and tracking hurricanes from space. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Trump administration released its budget plans for NASA, cutting nearly 25% of the space agency's upcoming funding. Programs like Mars Sample Return, the Space Launch System, and Orion spacecraft, and so-called green aviation spending would come to an end. We'll speak with the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer about this proposal and the future of NASA science if the plan is approved by Congress. Then, we're less than a month away from the start of the Atlantic hurricane season. With new technology, there are many ways to track these massive storms, including on and off our planet. We'll speak with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Matt Rosenkrantz about how the agency monitors severe weather ahead of the upcoming Atlantic hurricane season. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? A new budget proposal from the White House will cut about a quarter of NASA's budget if approved by Congress. The biggest budget cuts are to NASA's science divisions and legacy human exploration projects. According to the budget document, the cuts are aimed at beating China to the moon and getting the first humans on the surface of Mars. With these cuts, leading science organizations and advocates alike are voicing their concerns over just how devastating they would be for NASA science. In a letter to Congress, the Planetary Society and its partners outlined opposition and how the proposal would cause, quote, immediate and irreparable damage, end quote. Here to talk more about the budget plan and how it will impact the space agency is Casey Dreyer. He's the chief of space policy for the Planetary Society. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so let's start with this skinny proposal that came out, Casey. We anticipated cuts, as you talked about the last time you were on the show here. What were the actual cuts in this budget proposal?
NASA overall loses approximately 25% of its budget, a quarter top line. Now, most of that is on the shoulders of NASA's science activities, which would get an astonishing 47% cut year over year. The rest of it was distributed among a variety of other core NASA activities, including cutting a third from ISS operations, cutting money from roughly a third from NASA's kind of mission support overhead, that's salaries and infrastructure costs, and then cutting space technology in half, canceling Artemis components SLS and Orion after Artemis 3.
Before we dive into what the implications of those budget cuts may be, I want to get a sense of do we know the reasoning or the motivation that the Trump administration put forward with these cuts? What's the explanation for a cut as drastic as you've described?
They gave some, and this is the essence, I guess, of the skinny budget. This is basically a page and a half, a table with some text next to every major cut. So it's a little bit, but it's really not that much, mainly pointing out using very polarizing, politicized language of quote unquote unnecessary and low priority climate observations, low priority research, critiquing Mars sample return, which is explicitly canceled in this skinny budget for being over budget and unaffordable, things being too expensive and not important to the administration, basically.
Let's talk about those cuts. You've already mentioned one that I wanted to tackle, the Mars sample return. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, the Perseverance rover was sent to Mars to grab these samples and then send them back with Mars sample return. What happens now?
Again, it's really hard to say. The budget explicitly calls out Mars sample return as being over budget, that the goals would be achieved by human missions to Mars anyway, so why do this? And it does redirect money from the cancellation of SLS and Orion and Gateway, I should also say, to human space exploration Mars initiatives. What those are, it does not say. But that claim that humans could do this Mars sample return anyway, theoretically, yes, if they land at Jezero Crater, which is not clear, and they probably wouldn't, given the relative uncertainties and safety considerations for landing humans. The timeline of when that is, of course, critiques MSR for not returning samples until the 2030s. There's just no way that humans will get to Mars and back by the 2030, you know, on a sooner time frame. I mean, the idea is essentially that by adding the orders of magnitude more complexity and cost required to send humans to Mars, you will actually be a more efficient and faster return of samples. Does not make sense to me. But that is in a sense that, you know, at the moment, what this implies is that those samples will sit on the surface of Mars indefinitely.
You did mention that that money did go into human space exploration, though. It got a boost. Can you talk about what is getting bolstered by moving this money around? I think it's a $650 million boost.
Well, I think the important thing here is that it's not a boost, actually. It's misrepresenting what it's doing because it cuts $880 million from other human exploration systems. So human exploration overall still goes down by over $200 million. It says $1 billion of new investment. It says for Mars to focus programs. What are those? It doesn't say. It's not clear what our national policy is for sending people to Mars. There is no national policy for that yet. Again, a lot unspecified. I mean, this is part of the weirdness of that. We don't have a confirmed, as we're recording this, we do not have a confirmed NASA administrator. We don't have a National Space Council. We don't have an updated national space policy. But this budget seems to suggest that there is some sort of national policy that just hasn't been shared yet. And even though, you know, and $1 billion, sure, that's real money, but it's really not enough to get you anywhere close to Mars, right? We're spending right now $3 billion a year on the Artemis human landing system private components, right? To SpaceX and Blue Origin. $1 billion a year is what we spend just on the ground operations for the International Space Station that has been up there for 30 years, right? $1 billion is less than what we spend on space technology. It's in the scheme of spending, not that much. And so it's moving money that is being used for other programs right now into what is at the moment a relatively ill-defined Mars program. But I think that this distinction here is that it's unclear what it's doing. It's unclear how the money is going to be spent. And there's some serious, serious costs to good, productive, and very valid and important NASA programs while this paltry amount of money is being redirected for this probably unrealistic Mars effort.
Again, I know that this is speculation because this is just the budget proposal. Congress still has to hash this out. But when we talk about these Mars programs, it has been for many years, moon then Mars. But it sounds like these cuts make that nearly impossible to even get to the moon, right? I mean, is Artemis in jeopardy as well based upon this proposal?
I'd say one way to read this budget is that Artemis survives until Artemis 3. We land on the moon and then now it's Mars. That isn't the long-term permanent commitment to cislunar exploration, lunar surface capabilities that the first Trump administration made, the Biden administration followed up with. And it's actually required if you want that kind of commercial and private capital to flow into making the cislunar economy. You need to know that the U.S. is going to be there. This is a very light on the details budget, but you know, it does seem to fund Artemis through the first landing, which again doesn't say anything really much beyond that. So that's where, again, you really start to question what is the long-term goal and are we serving and are we kind of keeping our commitments nationally, not just to our international partners, which are kind of, you know, out of luck in a lot of ways on this budget, but to our commercial partners who have raised money and are building the infrastructure to support a long-term presence at the moon.
Casey, historically, has NASA ever seen a budget cut of this magnitude?
No, not even close. I mean, this is important to remember. Even during the ramp down after Apollo, the largest single year drop in NASA's budget was 14%. And this is 25%, the largest one proposed ever by the White House. If enacted, obviously, it would be the largest, you know, relative amount canceled. And, you know, if you look at inflation adjusted, right, this would bring NASA down to $18.8 billion. If you adjust for inflation, the last time NASA had a budget close to that level was 1961, before Johnson Space Center existed, right, before Stennis existed. And that was a very different NASA back then. And NASA has never been this low since then, right? This will not make NASA more efficient. This will not make the implementation of programs more efficient. It will do the exact opposite, because if someone is grabbing the wheel and driving you off a cliff, will not make your driving better, right? Like, this is a very dramatic, very sudden imposition of a radical change in policy. And projects that have been on time and on budget in this proposal are canceled. Projects that are, you know, that we're relying on our international partners and commercial partners to build out are left with great uncertainty. The radical ways that you have to cut this much money this quickly require you to turn off perfectly well-functioning, highly productive spacecraft in midstream. Those aren't efficiencies. Those are wastes. This is a budget that will create long-term waste of taxpayer dollars and a long-term detriment into U.S. capability and U.S. leadership, not just with space science, but space technology and the fundamental industrial capacity of the United States.
And again, I know this is speculative, but what are the chances that Congress actually goes through with this?
We need to take this really seriously. And yes, ultimately Congress has to approve funding, but Congress has not approved appropriations on time by the start of the fiscal year since the late 1990s. And any interim period where they don't shut down the government, where you have a what's called a continuing resolution, where you extend last year's budget levels temporarily, that's not actually what it sounds like. What happens is that the White House's budgeting office will ramp down the rate of spending to match the lowest possible budget scenario that is being considered. In this case, this one. So anytime Congress will be dawdling on appropriations, this will be the budget that NASA will be working to. This budget is official policy now, so NASA cannot make new contracts, cannot make long-term planning. Immediate grants and other kinds of contracts for its uses now that extend beyond next year, because this is their planning scenario. And the longer Congress takes to respond to it decisively, the more impact this will have. Because even if ultimately the money comes back, say, 3 or 6 months after, you know, being imposed this lower level, can you turn the spacecraft back on that you had to shut off? Can you find the people you had to let go who know how to run and talk to Voyager built 50 years ago? Can you rebuild that quickly? You probably can't. You will have a serious and long-term destruction of institutional knowledge, and likely serious destruction to actual hardware, taxpayer-funded hardware that you will not be able to revive.
Casey, your organization, the Planetary Society, member-funded nonprofit organization, it's dedicated to advancing space science, and many of its members believe in that and the work that you do. What are you telling them at this particular time in history where NASA is facing historic cuts?
Well, first, I think we're emphasizing that this is very serious. This is profoundly serious. We're in a very dangerous situation for these types of activities done by the public sector in the United States. The second thing we tell them is that there is no private option for this. These activities, particularly in science, will not be replaced by private capabilities because there's no market for them. These go away, they are gone. The third thing we tell them is that because of the consequential nature of this and the long-term potential impact to U.S. capability and U.S. leadership, this is the time, if you have ever been on the fence about contacting your elected official, to talk to them now. And to not just do it once, but to do it over and over again, to find ways. And then this is important for us too, to begin engaging your local community. For those of our members who are scientists or who have worked on these projects, whether as an engineer or any capacity, to start talking to their local community, local op-eds, local news websites, Reddits, subreddits, whatever, to say, you know, this isn't money that's floating in outer space. This is money and jobs and capabilities here and in this community and that community. Talking about how these are things that we have built up that is not just important and inspiring, but unique. A representation, I believe, of the fundamental virtues of this country. Curiosity, aspiration, tenacity, cooperation, the ability to seek out the world as it is and draw joy and inspiration and challenge from that. These are represented in these types of capabilities by sending something to Pluto, to sending something to interstellar space, to peering further back in time than had ever been done before to see the origins of the universe. These are things that literally do bring out the best in us. And if we don't do them, that correspondingly says something about us as a nation, that we are turning away from not just looking outwards, but we're turning inwards. I think often about this image of someone hunched over their cell phone in front of the Grand Canyon, swiping away and getting angry at something on social media when some majestic viewpoint, you know, just is right in front of them. This is the national equivalent of doing that. This is a budget of retrenchment, and this is a budget of looking down and inwards. And I think our country is better than that. And I think our country needs to be the ones looking outwards. And we still can. And that's if we will not go down without a fight on this.
Casey Dreyer is the chief of space policy for the Planetary Society. Casey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still to come, tracking earthly weather from the ground all the way up in space.
We're starting to see things we've never seen before. Vortexes within vortexes, so tiny little eyewalls, and eyewall replacement cycles and the structures of these storms. All possible because, you know, the amazing scientists that put those satellites together.
That's just ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Before we jump into talking about the weather, we want to let you know that here at Central Florida Public Media, we're in our spring fund drive, and we need to hear from you. If you didn't know, Are We There Yet is made possible because of listener support. If you value the high quality, trusted news and information that we provide each week with this show and the other programs at Central Florida Public Media, please consider making a contribution. Do it by calling 1-800-785-2020 or go online at cfpublic.org. And thanks. Now, how do we track giant storms like hurricanes from space? The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, otherwise known as NOAA, collaborates with NASA on several science-based missions, including the Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellites that help track earthly weather and space weather above Earth's surface. These satellites provide a lot of data for scientists, and these images help with forecast predictions to help prepare people for a major storm like a hurricane. Our producer, Marion Summerall, spoke with Matt Rosencrantz, NOAA's lead hurricane seasonal forecaster, about how the science agency studies major storms and how we can prepare for the upcoming Atlantic hurricane season that starts next month. Here's part of that conversation now.
Matthew, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Tell me a little bit about the hurricane research that happens off our planet, maybe a little bit above our planet.
We will have wind-driven kind of drones that go out, and they're called sail drones, and they will sail into the hurricanes. Got buoys that also drift around. And then you move up to where you've got the hurricane hunters, my colleagues that fly into the hurricanes. And we've got even higher than that, NOAA flies G4s, which fly up, 40,000-50,000 feet up into the top of the storms and drop in instruments that take measurements as they fall. And then even higher than that, right, up to the satellites. Polar orbiting satellites are much closer to the surface of the Earth and kind of orbit the Earth, a couple times a day. And then way out there at 22,000 miles, we've got the geostationary satellites that are above the same point on the Earth all the time. And they take a picture every minute or 5 minutes of the full Earth that they can see.
And some of those satellites you mentioned, I mean, we're getting some incredible photography.
Yeah, those amazing pictures where you see, they're kind of some of my favorites. And even why I kind of got into looking at hurricanes in the first place was they just look so incredible on satellite image. It's a beautiful, but it's destruction underneath it. And it was so captivating to me as a young person that made me want to get into meteorology and get into this. And that was since like the eighth grade. And the satellites do paint amazing pictures of them, right? Like they capture that image every minute now for sectors of the planet. So we can zoom in and take amazing pictures, like 1 kilometer resolution and every minute. So we can really give the forecasters a ton of information about the minute-by-minute changes in the centers of these storms. And we're starting to see things we've never seen before. Vortexes within vortexes, so tiny little eyewalls and eyewall replacement cycles and the structures of these storms. All possible because, the amazing scientists that put those satellites together.
While these images look incredible, right, these pictures provide a lot of information. What kind of information? I mean, what are we able to learn from a satellite image of one of these massive storms?
Yes, it's a sensor that looks like a photograph, right? That looks kind of like what your eyeball might see because that's what we make it look like. But there's also a ton of data behind that, the infrared spectrum behind it. It can see things in spectrum and in wavelengths that the human eye can't see because that's, there's material scientists who engineered that stuff. You can see where the thunderstorm clusters build, how fast they're building. The density of lightning strikes now. That's something we have only in the latest version of the geostationary satellites. So you can see like bursts of lightning. And then 8 hours later, you see the storm intensity go up by 20 knots. See, is that convection kind of reinvigorated the storm? From the lower orbiting satellites, we'll see eyewalls and the centers of the storms that are not round. They're more like hexagonal, sometimes they're square. And there's research going on into, does a transformation from a hexagonal, which has 6 points, to a square, which has 4 or 2, does it go from the less points, the worse it is, the less stable it is, to more points where it's closer to perfectly round? Is that a more efficient structure? Is there something in between? And then can we even model that, right? So there's not only like what it looks like from space, but then you can also, because of the ability to do the things and measure it with things that look like pictures, but also what are called the imagers and the sounders that give you the vertical profile of temperature that can then be ingested into the models that we run. So for like the MSU-A and MSU-B, the microwave sounding units, it can tell us like the vertical distribution of moisture in that storm. So really what kind of environment is that storm in to rapidly intensify to kind of keep cruising as normal, or is it going to be in a tough environment? That storm might kind of fall apart. And the more years of this data we have, the more we can fine tune how those measurements turn out in the real world 24, 36, 5 days later.
Right. And then it helps, obviously people get prepared. You're in the know. Just from what you said, I mean, these new ways of monitoring these storms from satellites to even some of you mentioned, like you have your friends flying into the storm, which I think is wild. I'm like picturing, actually, I know it's not a hurricane, but I'm picturing the movie Twister of like them driving. I mean, it's revolutionary.
Yeah. I mean, right from the satellites we launched in the 60s, and the first real good weather satellites in the mid 70s, it kind of showed us actually that up until probably the mid 70s, we were undercounting the number of storms that's out there. And now we have satellite data and things that are so good that we're seeing more short-lived storms. You'd have to add anywhere between 2 and 5 storms from the 1960s, 50s, 40s, all the way back into the 1800s. You want an accurate number of storms, you probably want to add between 2 and 5 more in those years, because they're just, maybe a storm went between shipping lanes out there and you didn't really see it, or short-lived. It was only out there for 2 days. We call them shorties. But then there's also the other part of NOAA's mission. So the low Earth satellites and some of the commercial satellites that are being put up there, they have incredible, just absolutely amazing sensors on them where they can take pictures with, they can see your car from space, right? That data can come back into NOAA to show where barrier islands are this year, because they actually change from year to year. Winter can change the shape of the Outer Banks of North Carolina. And then where is that before the hurricane season? So then we can put that into our surge modeling and then model the surge better. And then we can have those same satellites fly over again afterwards to be able to help the emergency managers direct recovery efforts, recovering the coastline so that the next storm is less impactful. Recovering, NOAA has the Office of Coast Survey. So how do we go out there and get ports open again after storms go by so we can do those surveys? And that is largely from space. And then we have aircraft that fly with downward looking cameras and sensors that fly. So, this space from, 15,000 feet on up to 150 miles, right? It's just, we can have tools there that really let us try and keep everyone safer. When something happens, recover everything as fast as we can.
And Matthew, while we're talking, we're in May right now. This season is just around the corner. For a lot of people, it can be a little bit more of a scary time. I know that NOAA's annual hurricane outlook will be released in the following few weeks, but I want to talk about some of the underlying factors that you think will be the most impactful in this upcoming hurricane season.
Yeah. So last year we ended up with 18 tropical storms in the Atlantic. 11 of them became hurricanes. Usually it's about 40%. So we should have been at 9 or 8 hurricanes. We had quite a bit more hurricanes last year, and then 5 major hurricanes. With Helene and Milton just absolutely bringing devastation. Beryl before that with the earliest category 5 on record. So last year had some major high points. It also had some quiet points. End of August, we had a very busy late September and then through October, but right during the peak of the hurricane season, was kind of quiet for a couple of weeks. So you get those fluctuations within the season. So that's why we want people to start preparing now, because it could be an early season. And with like we had with Beryl last year, and then you might not hear so much for a little while, but you don't want to get caught without being that preparation early in the season. And then if you don't use it till later, well, you had it and it's less stressful to run out and grab it later. Things we always look for every year, and I'll talk about specifics, but things we look for every year is kind of, are we in a kind of multi-decade high or low activity era, which we're in a high activity era now, and the sea surface temperature in the Atlantic support a high activity era that's ongoing. And usually those take about 18 months to flip. So we haven't flipped now, so we won't flip for this season, right? We'd start to see something kind of this year if we're going to flip for next year, but it would stay through this year, and we're not seeing that yet. Status of El Nino is the next biggest thing. Right now, we're in an ENSO neutral condition, so kind of right in the middle, and that is the current forecast for ENSO neutral with a greater than 50% chance of being neutral through August, September, and October, which is the core of the hurricane season, makes about 90% of it. I'm talking with the team here that are the experts in monsoon forecasting. because we're looking at the West African monsoon and the strength of that. That is a huge factor in the numbers of storms that form in the Atlantic. That we think that's one of the contributing factors why it went so quiet last year is because the West African monsoon went so far to the north in Africa. There was rain in parts of southern Libya that hadn't seen rain in 40-something years. The way that plays into hurricanes are there's waves in the atmosphere that move from east to west across Africa. And then when those move out over the warm waters of the Atlantic, if those waves are strong, they will survive and can and form the seeds of hurricanes. If they are weak, typically they just kind of fizzle out and you don't get the storms. If they interact with too much dust in the air, which is only measurable by satellite, right, so that's kind of one of the things that's kind of changed in the last 20 years is that appreciation of the African air layers or the Saharan air layer and the amount of dust in the air. They had missions to fly into it, but they figured out you can do it from satellite measurement really well. But then when the African monsoon got so far to the north last year, those waves were coming off of Africa, basically over southern to southern Morocco. And that water's kind of cold off the coast in Morocco, kind of like the cold water off California. So it's coming off over cold water, those waves. That's how far north they were. So that's why we had that kind of, we think that's why we had the quiet period right around the peak of the hurricane season. And then as that monsoon, which goes to the north, and then it, as it starts to settle back down to the south, as the African monsoon kind of relaxed for a year, we got that flurry of activity September, October, into early November.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. Wow. It's crazy to think that these other weather patterns that are going on in another continent are impacting these storms that we're seeing here, right? And that's just very fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's the whole planet is connected in so many ways. And, you know, to take it back to the earlier point, the satellites that we have, right? So we have NOAA satellites, goes east, goes west, our polar orbiters. EUMETSAT, they're this big geostationary satellite over Africa. Satellites from Japan, satellites from China. And we all share that data and we push it all together. And that's how we really get these pictures of what's going on the planet. That's how we get the best picture of what's going on today, what has been going on the past days, months, and then stitch that together to say, you know, storms going in X place or how many storms are coming in the next week, 2 or 6 months.
Matthew Rosenkranz is NOAA's lead hurricane seasonal forecaster. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was great being here and talking about the cool stuff of space and hurricanes. And I really do hope that, you know, everyone takes the time now to prepare for the upcoming hurricane season.
That was Are We There Yet's producer, Marion Summerall, speaking with NOAA's Matt Rosenkranz. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really, wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. Our handle is at AWTY Space on both Instagram and Facebook. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you'd be a good guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewetthereyet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.